8:01 a.m. on March the 8th, year 2023. Heather's basically conducted a roll call when people have called in. And again, she said, if when anyone joins, please introduce yourself. And if it's a complainant, introduce yourself just with your initials, please. Does anyone have any conflicts of interest to declare on any agenda item today? Okay, hearing none, let's move on to our minutes, number four. We just have our general session minutes from February 8th, 2023. Does anyone have any additions or corrections to make on the minutes? Hearing none, I will go ahead and make a motion to accept general session board meeting minutes as written for February 8th, 2023.
Seconded.
Dr. Thurman, you need to... Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right, let's move on to five, which is our items for board review, discussion, and possible action. A is our investigation files. We are going to go ahead then and start with complaint 22-16-C, which is Dr. Dahuki. And the investigator on that case is Dr. Saunders. We have the complainant, LB, is also present telephonically. So we'll go ahead and hear the report from Dr. Saunders, please.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Mr. Crawford? I'm sorry. Don't you know the...
I should invite you. I'm sorry.
Okay, to summarize here, my report here, I'll go through a complaint 2216C. LB alleged that Dr. Dahuki did not release the medical records to her after her surgical procedure in a timely manner. She also alleged that the procedure that was performed for her surgically, specifically the internal fixation that he had placed in her, was performed incorrectly and led to another surgery. Dr. Hickey, he confirms that he did treat the patient in his response with some conservative therapy prior to the surgical procedures. He related that during the procedure, specifically regarding the fixation, that it was good and stable fixation intraoperatively. Regarding the medical records, there was a conversation that the records are available through a portal system, which we'll review, and that the x-ray copies could be provided separately if a fee was paid. Dr. Dahuki does admit that LB did request the records through the portal system. There was some communication issues when that message was actually received. Records have thus been confirmed and have been provided. I'll go over some of my review first with the medical records. It was confirmed that medical records have been received by LB, to this date at least. First, LB was seen in July of 2021. Patient was evaluated, treated for hallux valgus, deformity. Physical examination was performed. X-rays were ordered at that point. And then a treatment plan was then put in place. There's reports or communication that there was some conservative therapy and injection at this point, but it wasn't documented in the charting at that point. And there was a prior history noted for a previous bunion surgery on the contralateral foot. Patient returned a week or so later, 2 weeks later rather, for the x-ray review, and then discussion was made for surgical planning. Regarding specifically on a document here, correction of subluxation, a fusion of the met cuneiform hallux valgus correction of Taylor's bunion, resection of partial resection of bone, and osteotomy first and fifth, all was discussed. Discussion for alternative conservative therapy was at least documented in the chart. Patient subsequently, 2 weeks later or so, 3 weeks later, had the surgical procedures. I listed them in the report. There are numerous that are reported here. To review here, the reduction of the subluxation, first metatarsal cuneiform, tarsal metatarsal arthrodesis is reported, partial resection of the first metatarsal head, a synovectomy, closing wedge osteotomy, proximal hallux, a partial resection of the fifth metatarsal head, a separate osteotomy of the fifth metatarsal shaft, fluoroscopy for manipulation, and then a posterior splint. These were the surgical procedures on the operative report. Follow-up courses during post-operative report, really relatively normal healing without complications. Fitted for a CAM boot, suture removals. That's documented that there's no complaints. Subsequent visits really documented normal progress, x-rays are in good alignment. The patient was traveling at some point during the recovery, approximately, I think, 6 or 7 weeks after. Was traveling, had some problems, and went to an emergency room, was treated with an infection with some Bactrim. The emergency room did an MRI, and there was concerns regarding osteomyelitis, which was addressed later. The patient was given some Bactrim at that point. Patient never did get the MRI done. She was seen subsequently with Dr. D. And since the patient was clinically doing well, the decision at that point to defer the MRI was performed. Patient was following up on a weekly basis at that point. All through the course, it's documented that the patient was healing was normal and within guidelines. Patient subsequently did return to regular shoes, developed a new pain in the area that was treated with a cortisone shot, ruling out an aroma. And according to the notes and Dr. D's, there was really no complications to be mentioned. Looking at my charts request, it looks like LB documents that records requests were made multiple times through the portal system and through communication verbally with the office staff. Her documentation shows at least three separate times through a portal system. There was some evidence of copies of the emails that were made. There was also a medical release that was provided from July from the Berlin Hospital where she was seen from the trying to obtain some records, not from the ED, from the follow-up care. I reviewed the radiographs myself, so I had copies of them provided. And the pre-op is consistent with the hallux valgus, with the Taylor's bunion preoperatively. Surgical course, there is one staple fixation that's netted across the arthrodesis site. Overall alignment of the first metatarsal postoperatively surgically, it looks to be very good. Radiographs, there's not a full consolidation of the arthrodesis, whereas on the osteotomies, it does appear to be completely healed at 10 weeks, and there is some bone callus production. In interviewing with the LB, she relates that she was extremely frustrated throughout the whole process, primarily because she just never got her records, and she wanted to seek other care when she was in another state. And there was, communication issue that she needed her records and wanted just to look at them, whether she was going to have another physician review them or not. She had said that she had made, and she can speak for herself in a few moments, but she made multiple requests through the portal system, and she made communication with the office staff. She did pay $40 for her records as was requested by the office, and overall it took about 2 months or so for her to get her records, which she feels delayed her care. She also relates in that she did not progress well, like the records state she did. She had mentioned on each visit on follow-up her communication to me that she mentioned to Dr. D, and he said everything looks fine. She couldn't work, which is why she ended up moving to another state, back with her family, where she had some assistance with life. She did seek a second opinion, and I did not review those records at that point, but it was communicated that some of her problems were because the fixation was not ideal. Most of the communication with Dr. D was through email. He relates that the records have always been available through the portal system. However, the x-rays are not available through the portal system. And this is where the communication, I guess, had a problem. He would only dispense digital x-rays on a thumb drive of some sort, rather than just provide the original Xerox copy. And I believe his rationale was that the mimeograph Xerox copy is not reliable enough for diagnostic quality. That's what I used. I thought it was okay. There was not a formal request actually made via signed documentation that we saw. And he can elaborate a little bit on how he feels about his digital copy with x-rays. In review for the radiographs, for the fixation, he believes that it was stable fixation at the time of the procedure. I had some concerns regarding the actual surgical billing. I think there was some uncoupling done, as multiple procedures were billed for the really main procedure that was done. I listed there the different surgical codes that were billed in there, specifically like a Taylor's bunion, a separate exostectomy was performed, as the same with the hallux, a synovectomy, a subluxation of the first metatarsal cuneiform was billed separately as opposed to the arthrodesis. And I documented that for you. I cut and pasted a little copy Mr. Crawford sent to us regarding the biller. The billing provider provided billing accordingly to the procedures performed in different locations. This was the CPT codes. I think Dr. D is relating that the billers were billing it, not himself. And I think we've addressed this before in the board. It's always up to the surgeon to report what they're supposed to be billed. So in my summary, I did have problems with the billing, as mentioned. I think there was a significant communication failure with the way that the records are provided. If the portal is the way to request them and get the renorts, I think it needs to be done in a timely manner. You know, in this day and age with difficulty in staff, I understand that communication with the emails is not necessarily done every day, but I think it needs to be done in a little bit more timely manner. I think we have to improve a way that we relate radiographs for patients. I think this whole complaint would have been avoided if we just got this LB or records and x-rays at that time. We discussed some of the billing. I think that the fixation is not ideal, but I do not see a breach in the actual procedure itself. I think the staple placement is in there. If the physician says that it was stable at the time, it was. Retrospectively, sure, maybe it could have been more fixation than there, or maybe a cross fixation. But I think it's within the standard of care the way it was performed. It does not appear to have migrated during the recovery process. As it goes through the x-rays, the staple itself seems to be in the same position it was placed into. And it does not look like it was fully healed. But the patient was lost to follow-up only at 3 months, and no additional care was done by the doc. Dr. D, that is. I can answer some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Sanders. You answered a few that I had, and that was regarding the time between requesting your records and receiving records, the absence of a sound release in the chart from the office, the issue about the fixation choice, the uncoupling of the procedures, and I totally agree that when you're lost to follow-up at 3 months, a lot can happen between now and I didn't see any evidence in charting, and I don't know if you did, that there was no injury during the post-operative period that could have caused, you know, the issue with the fixation site. And fully agree that the communication and the access to the portal, like, you know, having somebody in the staff every day checking those emails several times a day to prevent that missing requests.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue really was more of just getting a copy of the digital records or of the radiographs in this particular case.
Well, that does mess up with it. When you don't get those, that certainly affects continuity of care. Do you have any questions?
No, he's very complete.
Dr. Ilana, do you have any questions for Dr. Sanders?
Sure. Dr. Sanders, other questions. A formal request. What is needed for a formal request, and how much time should a provider take to get the records over?
Well, to me, a formal request is actually just a signed document saying, "Hey, I want my records." I think that the portal system would work. I mean, that's like an email documentation. I think that's appropriate. What I'm referring to is actually what we do in our typical offices is we sign it. Now, when a patient's out of state, you have to email or fax it and go back and forth. I've been practicing for a long time. I thought it was 2 weeks is the typical time period that you're supposed to get your records back and forth. you know, sometimes if you're emailing, it may take a little bit longer, or rather doing snail mail US mail, it may take a little bit longer, but that's a typical response period. I think it's appropriate.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. And we also have the complainant on the line, LB. And if I remember correctly, if you would like to make a statement, you're more than welcome. If not, the board will certainly, if anyone has questions to ask you, we can do that, if that's okay by you.
Yes, I don't have a statement, but I can ask your question.
Okay. Okay, so what we'll do here is then, since we can ask you questions, but I'm going to go ahead and ask Dr. Tahuki for a statement, or Mr. Crawford.
Yeah, Dr. Campbell, I'll just make a few brief remarks, and then Dr. Tahuki is on the line to answer any questions you have. In terms of, I'm not going to go in any particular order here. In terms of the billing issue, Dr. Tahuki will tell you he's had a real struggle getting good billing companies to work with. He doesn't even have one right now. He's got a new software system, which he hopes is going to improve that issue. And he's obviously had discussions with staff about this whole situation. He's doing his best under circumstances that are not ideal for any practitioners in these days. Secondly, in terms of the delay, there was miscommunication. She apparently made a request through the portal. Dr. Tahuki was not notified of that. Staff did not send the records in response to that. I don't believe, if my memory is correct, we ever got an actual HIPAA-compliant medical record release, which is really the formal way to be requesting the records. But we're not in any way blaming the patient. She was trying to get the records. We understand that. There was a bit of a delay. The way the system works is that the medical records are available to view on the patient portal. So they're always able to go into the portal and look at the records. The issue is getting copies of the records. You know, Dr. Tahuki, I think like all of, you know, most physicians out there, defers to staff. And, you know, that's their job to follow up on that. And so the x-ray issue is a little bit different. The x-rays are in a different system. They're not something you can look at on the patient portal. And what his procedure has been is he doesn't believe providing Xerox copies is the appropriate way, because they are not diagnostic. And so what patients are told, at least supposed to be told, is that for a small fee, copies of the x-rays can be provided on a USB. Another option is the provider that they're seeing, if the patient will provide an email address for that person, then they will be sent an invite and told that they can access the digital x-rays on the system. So there is no intent here to withhold medical records or x-rays from patients or providers. There was a little bit of a breakdown here. He apologizes for that. When I got involved and I saw there was some confusion, I contacted the patient directly, sent her Xerox copies of everything, including the x-rays, and then also provided her by mail a copy of the digital x-rays on a USB. So we've gotten that all cleaned up. I can't speak to any delay of treatment somewhere else. We haven't seen any records that say there was a delay actually in any treatment. The surgical technique was appropriate. Dr. Tahuki confirmed it intraoperatively with the fluoroscopy. Choice of fixation is doctors have different choices, and they do what they think is appropriate at the time of surgery. And clearly, at 3 months, it's too early to have, in many circumstances, complete healing. So, he apologizes. It's never been his intent to withhold medical records or x-rays from patients. There was some breakdown here. It's generally speaking, and he's not trying to blame his staff. He understands he's ultimately responsible, but in reality, doctors defer to staff and delegate that task to staff. In terms of the billing issue, yeah, he can tell you about his struggles trying to find someone who's good with that, and that he's purchased a new system, and he has discussed all of these issues with his staff, despite the fact he's experiencing high turnover in that area. He is doing his best to educate everybody about the importance of providing medical records, x-ray availability, and better communication. So he's really here. I think I've summarized his position. I'm not going to, he can add in anything he wants, and he's available to answer your questions. Oh, I guess the one thing I didn't address, let me address. In terms of how the patient was doing after surgery, you know, the records are made contemporaneously, and they're based on asking the patient questions. And so, you know, his records clearly show that the patient, generally speaking, was doing pretty well postoperatively. But obviously, when you lose somebody at 3 months, that's pretty early on. So that's what I have to say. Thank you, Dr. Kimmel.
Dr. Dahuki. So if you'd like to make other comments, and we can ask you questions.
I'd like to make a couple of comments. One is for the billing. When you build the billing person and build through our system, according to the ARC report, and the insurance company essentially scrams it, and the leak would come aloud different procedures coverage. And that is going by the villain. We are essentially, if you look at the villain, we got very small amount payment for the total amount of surgery that we performed. This is now essentially look at the PCI coding and see if there's any conflict anywhere before we do any check, before we send it out. In regards to the records, when the patients are receiving the last visit, with, I believe, her parents, I specifically myself told her that records are available through the portal, and that x-rays would require a minimum fee of $25, and we will copy the x-rays and extend it to her, as she told me she was moving for her parents' home. This was done upon her leaving the office, specifically. And also, she was told that the doctor can provide the information in the email or her email, and we can allow the patient, the doctor, to review x-rays online. And that was my last discussion with her. Thank you.
I have a question, Dr. Dahuki. Did you review all the x-rays with the patient?
I have reviewed the x-rays with the patient in the office. We have a tablet that we can show the patient x-rays that are downloaded into the tablet.
Dr. Furman, do you have any questions for Dr. Dahuki? Dr. Ilana, do you have any questions for Dr. Dahuki?
Yes, Dr. Dahuki, do you have a formal way of patients requesting records if they wanted it, besides going into the portal?
Typically, are you referring to the records?
X-rays and records formally. Do they have to sign on
the portal? The portal is available to every patient. We encourage every patient when they register to have an email and access the portal. And that is a simple procedure. And most of our patients are on the portal because it allows. house for checking, updating personal information to you.
Dr. DeHoopa, this did you have any other questions, Dr. Yamamoto?
Yes. Actually, if you would have to ask it formally to obtain them. We told the patient, if you want your X-ray, we will copy it for you. And there's a nominal fee of $25. I didn't ask for any written request or any change. I just told the patient. It's available. Just has to follow the procedure or have a local doctor and then allow the doctor to go online and then do the X-ray.
Okay. No further questions.
So, Dr. DeHoopa, this is Dr. Campbell again. If you have a patient who is, an elderly patient who is not computer savvy, then what's your procedure for records?
If the patient is not able to access records to the portal, then we will provide the documents to the patient.
But if they're unable to navigate a portal system, if you have a patient who's unable to navigate a system,
we will print the records and provide them by printed records.
All right. Does anyone have any other questions? All right. So now we have the opportunity to ask our complainant KB questions. Excuse me. KB, this is Dr. Campbell. I'd like to know, did you follow all instructions regarding your non-weight-bearing status post-surgery?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And during the postoperative course, was there any injury to the foot, like a trip or anything like that? Or hitting the foot?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Foreman, any questions, sir?
Yes. Hi. Did Dr. DeHoopa go over the x-rays with you at every visit with this tablet?
Before my surgery, yes, he showed me and made the marks of what he was going to do, but after surgery, I never saw them. He would look at them and tell me that they looked good, but I did not see them.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Yamamoto, do you have any questions?
No questions. Thank you.
All right, then. All right. So, seems like pretty much as Dr. Saunders concerns that we need to discuss are the communication with the medical records and the billing issue. And, of course, we've heard from Mr. Crawford and Dr. DeHoopa and the mentioning of problems with billing companies. Still, that does happen, that's for sure. But it's still, I still agree with Dr. Saunders that that's the doctor's the captain of the ship and you're responsible for looking at those billings. And you, even though you might get paid for something that way, that's not the appropriate fashion to bill. And my question always is the billing company going to support the physician if there is a claim of an alleged fraudulent billing? Way down the line. So to me that's very important. Again, it appears that you've done some education with your office staff regarding these portals and requesting of records. But again, the incident has happened. I'm glad to see that that you apologized and that you're working on some things. I'm inclined to offer a LOC, a letter of concern regarding those very issues, the communication portal and the billing issue. Any discussion or anybody making a motion?
I just think a formal policy in the office has to be made. It's so this doesn't happen again, and for continuance of care, even although a Xerox copy, that would be the best thing for the patient. But I agree with Dr. Kidd.
Oh, I have another question, Dr. DeHookey. Do you have an office manual where all those things are listed? I mean, those are things that they used to always require. HIPAA always required, you know, an office manual, so it's in writing for your staff to see it and refer to it?
We changed quite a bit, and I'm the officer for HIPAA and make sure that there is HIPAA training on an annual basis through ICA in the office. However, we do have high turnover of employees in the office, so it's a catch-up with them all the time.
That seems to be the way of the world, isn't it? Dr. Lana, do you have any questions? Comments?
No, I don't. In today's world, with staffing turnover, it's very hard getting things done at the office. So I'm sure that Dr. DeHookey has also fixed that by talking to staff and making changes.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion to offer a letter of concern in regards to the issues of communication with medical records in the portal system and with the unbundling on the billing.
Second.
Any discussion? Second. Thank you, Doctor. Any discussion? I'm sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you. Alrighty. Now Dr. Farahani is here, so we're going to go ahead and hear case 2218-C, Dr. Catalia Gorman, who is present telephonically. Mr. Crawford is counsel, he's present. The complainant is not present telephonically. So I'll ask for your report, Dr. Fahan.
Excuse me. Can we just tell Dr. DeHookey he can hang up?
Oh, sure.
Sorry, yeah. Doctor.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'll call you, Doctor.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Can you hang up, too? For the call?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, everybody. So this is investigation report 22-18-C. It's against Dr. Gorman, license number 0004951. I'm Dr. Farahani. The date of this report was dated to February 1st of 2023. Here's a complaint information summary of allegations. BK reports the following. I first saw Dr. Gorman at Flagstaff Bone Joints Kimmins Clinic in fall of 2020 for chronic multiple right foot pain issues. And x-ray showed joint deterioration. We scheduled surgery for May 6th for fusion of the talus and the navicular. It was to be at the Flagstaff Bone and Joint Surgery Center in Flagstaff. Afterwards, things seemed to go well until the 8-week x-ray taken at KRMC showed a fracture of the plate. At my second post-op appointment with Dr. Gorman, she said the x-ray looked like the fusion was still mending properly and that I could have the broken plate removed if it caused pain. No other imaging was ordered. In August, I returned to Flagstaff Bone Joint to get an appointment with Dr. Gorman because of continuing pain in the right foot. At Dr. Gorman's office in Kingman, I was told that I could not see the doctor because I was no longer considered a surgical patient. It is unclear if this was the doctor's or Flagstaff Bone and Joints policy. Prior to surgery, I had to sign off, and I knew the doctors had a financial interest in the bone and joint surgery center. And the front desk said that there were too many new patients needing the surgery for Dr. Gorman to see me for the follow-up visit. Apparently, getting more patients through their surgery center was more important than caring for the existing patients. I was not offered a referral to anyone else for help and was never allowed to speak with Dr. Gorman. I had physical therapy till the end of 2021 with limited improvement. I'm assuming Dr. Gorman's surgical technique was correct. Should I have had a different type of a plate? Should more than one screw been used? Prior to the 8-week x-ray, had I had been released to not wearing bracing at night? Was this too soon, allowing for foot to move while I was sleeping? I will be getting a taller boot for my revision surgery, so it was Flagstaff bone and joints boot too short for the application? The talus slash navicularis is one of the most difficult joints to fuse, so it would be impossible to pinpoint why my fusion failed. My complaint is more directed at the lack of aftercare, specifically no three-dimensional imaging of the joint after the broken plate was discovered, no concern for my continuing pain or help for the additional painful problems in the right foot, total inaccessibility of Dr. Gorman for her existing patients with post-surgical problems in Kingman. I moved to Denton, Texas, May of 2022, where medical care is much more accessible. I've had a CT scan and two thorough examinations this fall. I will be having two surgeries to include revision of the failed talus, navicular fusion, tarsal tunnel nerve release, Morton's neuroma excision, and tumor tarsal shortening osteotomies, all on the same problematic right foot that Dr. Gorman was supposed to be helping me with. There was so much more that Dr. Gorman could have done to help me last year, but her lack of experience, lack of concern for existing patients cost me another year of suffering and months of additional rehabilitation. And Dr. Gorman responded with the following. She stated, I first met patient BK in 9-10 of 2020 at the Kingman Clinic, where she was referred for surgical consult regarding significant degenerative changes to her talus navicular joint. The Kingman Clinic is 150 miles away, and I go there once a month as an outreach clinic. And we have two nurse practitioners that are there full-time. Because of this, patients typically see combination of myself and nurse practitioner if they cannot wait to see me in Kingman or do not want to travel to Flagstaff, where I am based. At her first appointment, she had already been multiple providers for her foot and had previous surgery for a cyst excision over the talus navicular joint. We reviewed imaging and discussed treatment options. She made another appointment with me on 9-16 of 2020. I'm sure that you guys have pretty much read this entire letter that was submitted. So I, for the redundancy purposes, I'm going to move to the medical records review, and I went over all of it, and I had it by date. So it started on 9-10-2020. The patient was seen in Kingman Clinic, referred for surgical consult regarding significant degenerative change to talus navicular joint. 9-16, they request to review x-rays at patient's request and MRI. Further questions were answered, discussing her condition regarding her talus navicular joint arthritis as well as surgery and the recovery involved. Discuss and answer questions pertaining to Morton's neuroma in addition to ankle instability issues. Approximately 2 months later, they discussed talus navicular joint arthritis, further discussed new issues regarding Morton's neuroma, MPJ capsulitis, and talus bunion. At this time, there was an injection of Morton's neuroma at the time. Approximately a month later, on 12-10-2020, discussed worsening talus navicular pain, previous symptoms relating to capsulitis, Morton's neuroma, and talus bunion pain had resolved. The new chief complaining of new lateral column pain and lateral post to her insert. And they added lateral post to her inserts. Approximately a month and a half later, on 1-28 of 2021, there was no improvement to the lateral pain issues, reported having an on and off symptom since previous summer. It was concerned about a stress fracture. They reviewed previous MRI, which did not demonstrate any stress fractures, offered a CAMBU to see if that would relieve symptoms. Approximately 3 months later, on 3-9 of 2021, the patient sent important messages with additional questions. She did have the question about surgery. However, one of her concerns was she reported having pain all over her body and the fact that only one area was being addressed by surgery. At this time, she was more concerned about her fifth metatarsal pain and other areas. Discussed surgery for the talomandibular joint fusion would only address that one issue and would not address the other issues in her foot slash ankle. This was reported by the doctor. Patient remained concerned about having a stress fracture to her fifth metatarsal. Dr. Gorman offered that she, if she wanted her to repeat an MRI for her, she was concerned it would not have been seen on the MRI she had done the previous summer. She did request for MRI to be ordered, and order was placed. In this patient case, she also offered other conservative measures. Aside from surgery, explained that there's no urgency to surgery if she has reservations. Dr. Gorman also offered for her to have a second opinion regarding her various foot issues. Approximately exactly 1 month later, they had a televisit at which the patient decided to proceed with surgery for the talomandibular joint. On 5-4, a month later, there was surgical intervention. 2 weeks later, there was a two-week follow-up post-op seen by nurse practitioner Ogden. She's not taking anything for pain. That was noted in her note, noting that the pain she has now is less than it was prior to surgery, and she was very happy with the results. Approximately a month later, or 5 weeks post-op, the patient was seen by Dr. Gorman, at which this time there was no radiographic concerns, and she was told at 6 week mark she could work on transitioning to weight bearing as tolerance in Cambridge. She did have some erythema in the incision that looked pressure related from strapping the boot too tightly, and she was given instructions on her boot and was put on antibiotics as precaution, and given instructions to monitor and call if worsening appeared. About between 6:15 to 9:10, there was a physical therapy involved, Kim Deering, meeting, and in her note she had listed meeting all her short-term and long-term goals with the exception of demonstrating adequate gait sequencing. The physical therapist also suggested apparent compensation due to right sacral pain. On 7-8 of 2021, 9 weeks post-op, seeing Dr. Gorman, at this time she had an x-ray that demonstrated broken myotonic plates. However, hardware and fusion site remained stable radiographically. Clinically, the patient did not have any pain at the surgical site, but it was more complaining of a lateral pain as well as nerve pain along her tarsal tunnel. All of the patient's areas of pain and concerns were separate from her surgical site. I did an injection, I means Dr. Gorman, did an injection for her for a separate area outside of her surgery site, as well as to discuss other treatment options for her condition, again unrelated to her surgery site. She was also concerned about osteopenia on x-ray, and I did get her a referral to our osteoporosis clinic. On 9-9, last visit by Dr. Gorman, 9 weeks post-op, it was not symptomatic. She was too early to qualify as a non-union, and therefore Dr. Gorman would not have ordered the bone stimulator or done revisional surgery in 9 weeks post-op in someone who was asymptomatic at her fusion site. However, at her appointment on 9-9, where she still was not symptomatic over her fusion site, and radiographically, myself and the radiologist did not read for any signs of worsening appearance of the surgical site. I would have ordered CT scan for further evaluation of her fusion site healing if she was having pain at the fusion site. She was 4 months post-op at this time. About a month and a half later, on 10-21-2021, appointed with Melissa Ogden, nurse practitioner for tarsal tunnel syndrome. The HPI reported her joint pain had improved since her surgery in May. That's referring to the talomandibular joint fusion. But the underlying burning pain is still there and was there prior to her surgery as well. Melissa Ogden was to treat the patient for tarsal tunnel syndrome, and she gave the patient tarsal tunnel injection at that time. On 10-28, there was a follow-up. Patient voluntarily canceled and rescheduled to 10-29. On 10-29-2021, she was seen by the osteoporosis clinic. On 11-1, the patient sent a message to Melissa Ogden. The shot gave me in October did not help the nerve pain on the inside of my foot. I have constant pain when walking at the back of my arch and front of the heel. I am going back to PT on Friday to see if they can help me. Again, no mention of surgical site, being that this was all focused on separate problem for which she was returning to PT for. On 11/23/2021, she sent another message to Melissa Ogden saying, I have now had 32 PT visits, and I'm still having too much pain in my right foot. I would like to go ahead with the nerve conduction test with KRMC's Dr. Thien and go, or do you have someone else who recommend in Kingman? KRMC tells me the only thing I need to make an appointment is an order. The only two nerves that I feel need tested are the ones for tarsal tunnel and the other one that Dr. Gorman shot last visit between my little and second outside toes. Again, patient does not mention any pain to her surgical site. EMG, NCS, evidence of peripheral neuropathy recommended a course of Neurontin if neuropathic pain worsens. On 12/14/2021, Melissa Ogden reviewed the EMG results with the patient, offered her a course of Neurontin, which the patient declined. The office note states, the last injection that I did for her did not help. She states the injection that Dr. Gorman gave her on the lateral side of the foot helped some of with the lateral foot pain, which is still improved. She states everyone, testing, PCP, and etc., keeps saying it's tarsal tunnel, and she read that there is a release option for that. She would like to discuss her surgical option to fix this with Dr. Gorman. On 2/1/2022, appointment canceled, noting state insurance issues. On 2/16, there was an error in schedule at Kingman Clinic to see Dr. Gorman. Patient was actually scheduled for 2/17. Here's my take on this. Starting off with a surgical intervention, as I always say, is not an exact science, and surgical interventions do fail from time to time. And I believe a non-union is a risk with any joint fusion and surgical intervention. I reviewed the timeline of events. I believe that Dr. Gorman followed standard of care precisely, attempted to address issues present by the patient. From the initial appointment of 9/10/2020 to 5/4/2021, where the surgical intervention of joint fusion took place, approximately 9 months had lapsed, during which patient had ample time to discuss all issues at hand to provide an ease of mind for the patient. Regardless of that, the patient was also offered a second opinion, all of which shows was done according by Dr. Gorman. Furthermore, she was offered a second opinion, as I said, to further put her mind at ease. I don't see any indication of practicing below the standard care in all of the records which I reviewed. Reviewing all imaging pre and post-op, the correct procedure was performed. In reference to a broken plate, clinically there was no indication of pains cited by the patient at the procedure site. Therefore, with respect to an asymptomatic patient, a revisional intervention at the time was neither appropriate nor advisable. However, I do firmly believe that regardless of the symptoms associated to the surgical site, I, as a practitioner, would have definitely ordered a CT, and I think that would have been an appropriate measure. And I believe that Dr. Gorman failed to recognize. However, even with the presentation of the CT, a revisional surgery would not have been advised unless there was pistoning of the hardware present. This is merely my opinion and differs from each practitioner residency / fellowship training. And I'm saddened that the outcome was not favorable for this patient, but I can't see any issues pertaining to Dr. Gorman's treatment. So I found this allegation to be unsubstantiated.
Thank you, Dr. Farhani. You're always so complete. Appreciate that. What do you think could have caused the plate to break?
A lot of things. Non-compliance. Mm-hmm. It has happened to me. I asked the patient not to put any weight on it, be limited weight bearing, and the patient goes and for a walk for a mile. I mean, you know what? We never know, because we always want to take the good and the bad, and we want to think that everybody follows our post-op instructions, but unfortunately they don't. I mean, I've had patients that were very, very highly intellectual, and they came in after bunion surgery, and they had put their feet in vinegar. And so even though I specifically said, do not get wet, in their defense, I don't know, but I would say there was definitely, for a broken plate at a fusion site to happen, is that you must have done some traumatic event to it.
Right. Yeah.
So.
And I know there was nothing, indicated in the records that there was any trauma. Because looking at the x-rays, the placement looks really good.
And honestly,
a
doctor's job is to follow a patient as closely as possible. If you look at these timelines, regardless of whether this doctor is good or bad in terms of clinical scenarios, the doctor did everything he could. They followed up with the patient. What else can you do for a patient? Other than you provide a service. So that's what I think.
Oh, I agree with you. I was just wanting your opinion on that. Dr. Foreman, any questions?
No, I don't have any questions. Very complete.
Thank you. Dr. Alano, any questions?
No questions, please.
Okay, great. Would like to speak first, Mr. Crawford, and then we'll ask to hear from Dr. Gorman?
Sure, just very briefly. the records, the x-rays show that Dr. Gorman provided good quality care. There was good follow-up. When you have a satellite office, so to speak, you can only get there so often, but it is staffed with two nurse practitioners who are independent providers who can see the patient, who can call the doctor if there's a problem, and the patient also has the option of driving to Flagstaff if they want to. So the idea that Dr. Gorman refused to see her or something like that, that's just not consistent with the system. The concept that she's not a caring physician or whatever, that's just belied by the records. She is a good doctor. She provided appropriate care. The CT scan issue, that's a doctor preference, but Dr. Gorman will tell you when the results are not going to affect the patient's care, then she would not do it at that time. The patient was asymptomatic. We're only 4 months post-op. So unless it is going to specifically affect the patient's care, her practice and training is not to order it at that time. Now, it might be ordered sometime after that if things change, but that was the situation at the time. And she's available and can answer any questions you have.
And, of course, we don't have the complainant is not on the line, so we won't be asking any questions there. So, Dr. Gorman, if you'd like to make some remarks and then answer some questions.
Just to touch on the CT scan, again, at 9 weeks out, with her being asymptomatic and no evidence of that being a hardware backing out, I was not going to order a CT scan because it wasn't going to change my plan at the time. I would not have taken her back at 9 weeks post-op fusion and removed hardware during revision at that time. And that's why we discussed monitoring it. And so that's why I saw her the following month and checked on things. She still was asymptomatic. She was scheduled to see it a month after, and I never saw her again. And it's unfortunate. I saw this patient quite frequently over the course of a year and a half, and for multiple issues even prior to the surgery. It's disheartening to hear that her interpretation of her care is what it is. But I unfortunately don't. It's not our policy to turn people away and shift access to their physician. So I don't know what she was communicated to her in that regard. It's unfortunate that the outcome is what it is. I was unaware of any of this. I last saw her in September of 2021, and I didn't know any of this was going on until I got the board complaint about a year later. So that's all I have to say. There's nothing else to add. I don't know if you have any questions for me.
Yeah, I do have one, and this is kind of just like a didactic conversation question. you know, she was saying she was having problems with her tailor's bunny, and she was ending up having some osteotomies with the neuroma, et cetera, and with the tarsal tunnel and the pain all over the body, the things, you know, that she would need, you know, some kind of other evaluation. Why was she having the tarsal tunnel and all this? But my question is this, with the surgeries that she says were going to be done in Texas, would you have done all those at the same time, or would you have staged those?
I would have staged those. I think it's multiple things too close together, you know, and they have different post-operative periods, you know, for fusion is a non-lethal period. So her other procedures that she had with her physician in Texas, you know, I would have them, you know, late during an event, you know, early on. So it's just the post-op course would be different. I think incisions, close skin bruises would be a concern for incision healing. So I regardless wouldn't have addressed all of those issues surgically at one time.
Yeah, that's what I was thought you would say. I was in agreement with that. Yeah. Dr. Foreman, do you have any
other question?
Okay. And again, Dr. Yolano, I'm going to ask you for anything.
I have no questions for Dr. Foreman.
Okay. So I think I will go ahead and make a motion to dismiss this case. 18-3
no violation of state statute.
Second. Thank you, Dr. Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you for participating, Dr. Gorman.
Thank you all for your time.
Okay.
Thank you. Nice seeing
Thanks
you.
Thanks, sir.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dr. Farhan. Alrighty. Well, we still have, Dr. Brower, we have a, this is under the investigation category 22-20-M. So that was, this was in response to a malpractice case. So everybody's had the opportunity to review documents that were presented in regards to this case, and the case was settled with no indication of liability, and it was what, without prejudice or with prejudice?
With prejudice.
With prejudice. Okay, so I just have this, you guys, do you want to review any more of the record from that, or have you read that? Okay, so I just have a question, Dr. Brower. Did that patient really weigh 120 pounds and he was 6 foot?
Yeah,
that's what I weigh, and I'm 5'6".
He had untreated anxiety, severe. I mean, he was just the most fidgety guy. Again, I don't know. I didn't do it. I should have done a tox screen. If I could have done anything different, I would have done a tox screen on this guy. I know he was on cocaine. Now, looking back on it, this guy was just fidgety, all this, you know, he smoked. No wonder he got hurt at work. I mean, I'm surmising, but.
Well, yeah, because I was like, the nutritional status, yeah. All this stuff, and I think, well, he had to have been in alcohol. I mean, this is what I must, you know, by the record. So I was just curious, yeah. Because when I saw that, I thought, mercy. But.
Struggled to heal.
Yeah. And again, you know, we all know what difficult injuries those calcaneal fractures are like that. So another didactic question, and I know, reading the orthopedic and the podiatry literature, there's, you know, is it best to do the ORLF? Do you know it's most likely going to go on to a fusion, or do you do the fusion first?
I personally, here's my struggle with, especially Sanders 4s. It's just, you know, Humpty Dumpty, and there's not enough, in my estimation, when I've been in there, I hear about doing these primary fusions, I struggle to understand why you would, only because there's so many bones floating in there. How do you get a good stable construct to compress that talus to the calc? So not only did I wait 3 weeks to get swelling down, because, you know, you don't injure just the calcaneus, you injure that whole envelope, he waited 3 weeks, he still ended up dehiscing. I did tell him, hey, look, there is a potential. No, we need to go back, remove this hardware, and do a fusion. But I wanted to let the bone consolidate, get some calcaneal height back in there, some anatomic reduction, before I went and did a fusion down the road. And it turns out that I think Dr. What's his name? treating physician.
Orthopedic foot and ankle.
Graves? Stanley Graves?
Yeah, he came to the same.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. That's just, you know, those are those unfortunate events when you've got somebody with that kind of medical status to begin with and then that kind of injury. And I know when I was in my training, there would have been orthopods who would just have amputated.
Yeah, that's right.
Honestly.
I have a patient right now, same situation. Post-cochlear fracture with a little bit of a dehiscence, a little cellulitis, and you know, it's the same situation. It happens.
Mm-hmm. I was with the orthopedic group and with the Core Institute for a while. And I'll tell you right now, our orthopedic colleagues will fight you over an ankle fracture, but boy, they'll happily give you those calc fractures, you know. They're difficult.
Yeah, they are.
I have no questions, I mean.
Dr. Yolanda? Dr.
No, no question.
Okay, thanks.
No question.
Okay. All right, well, so I'm going to go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 22-23-N.
Second.
No violation of state statutes. Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Right, okay. That's okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. While we have you there, Doctor, let's move on to, we're going to go down to C, to the initial analysis that we have, and I'm sure hopefully everybody is up to snuff on the article and what happened with this modern vascular, so have Dr. Brower give us his summary.
I'm going to refer to some of my notes. I did leave counsel. But first of all, thank you for your time. I feel bad that we're here having this conversation. With my comments, I'll mention one thing that I just read through this whole episode. But I'm here to address any concerns and questions the board may have regarding this article. Well, all that was an excerpt from a USA Today article that was printed from an Arizona Republic article that came out in the expose against modern vascular.
Excuse me, Dr. Bauer, can you speak into the mic, please?
Sorry, yeah. It's my auto. There we go, testing.
If there's a green light on, that's what you need.
Sorry, Dr. Bauer.
Wait, can you hear me now?
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry about that. A little history. I've been in practice for 19 years, 12 in Arizona, the last 12 in Arizona. This is my first time being before the board regarding any matters, so this is a little bit humbling for me. I started sending patients to Modern Vascular about a year before being asked to join as an investor. Modern Vascular offers endovascular treatment for PAD, below the knee and into the foot. Now, this new technology offered by interventional radiologists. My colleagues normally for lower extremity PAD work have been interventional cardiologists, and with this new technology, interventional radiologists are able to access the lower leg and into the pedal loop, which has been a game changer for my wound patients, my diabetic patients, my smokers. And so it was this technology that lured me into using the services of modern vascular. I guess lured doesn't sound like the right word. It convinced me. My patients got great care. Still to this day, they get wonderful care with modern vascular. It's the technology I'm in love with, and it's been so helpful to my patients. And so, and to this day, I don't think I've had one complaint of any patient who's ever been to modern vascular. My current patients still go there for continued treatment that I sent them 4 years ago. Modern vascular used an MSO model, which is a management service organization model, which many podiatrists across the valley for years have used for creams and genetic testing and all those sorts of things. I'm not an attorney, but I sought some legal advice and did due diligence and was told that this contract with Modern Vascular with physician investors was legal and ethical. But over time, over the course of about a year and a half, I began to notice some red flags with Modern Vascular, They refused to address some of my concerns about openness and transparency regarding their contractual obligations to us physician investors. I couldn't determine for myself if Modern Vascular was compliant in their contractual obligations due to their unwillingness to be open and forthcoming after multiple attempts by me asking for transparency. I therefore immediately cut ties as an investor. Again, Modern Vascular gave good patient care, which is paramount to me. Not one patient complaint I'm aware of, unless the board can correct me, regarding their care with Modern Vascular. My departure with Modern Vascular happened a year and a half before I became aware of any government investigations into their business practices. I have no knowledge of any Modern Vascular activities since departing in early 2021. I have patients who still go there for treatment and they get good care. I have one regret, giving an interview to a reporter from the Arizona Republic. I initially saw in him somebody who had mutual concerns about the unethical business practices of Modern Vascular began to have that led me to leave. He agreed with me about these concerns and regarding Modern Vascular's lack of transparency. It wasn't until his 10-page expose came out in the Arizona Republic that I realized he had misrepresented my opinion. He took a sentence or two out of context over an hour-long interview in my office. I reiterated to him multiple times throughout our meeting that my patients got good care from Modern Vascular. This wasn't a patient care problem. I cannot say that his quotes from me are wholly accurate, but I do know that they do not reflect nor represent who I am and my ethical core. I left Modern Vascular as soon as I sensed that they were not holding up their obligations and being transparent. That was an ethical decision I do not apologize for. I do regret how the reporter characterized my statements. They may be inaccurate and artful, but I realized afterwards he had a different agenda. In closing, I love what I do for a living. I love treating patients. I did a 3-year surgical residency and a fellowship to get as many tools in my belt as I could to help the most patients possible. My patients receive and are still receiving good care from Modern Vascular. I try every day to do right by my patients. I love my profession. I love people. I strive every day to not harm the sacred relationships I have built over 19 years with the podiatry community and, most importantly, my patients. Thank you.
Well, the press has a way of doing things.
I will never give another interview ever again. That's what I've learned.
Record it.
Right. Oh.
Do you have any comments or questions?
No, I mean, it just, after reading, you know, the first article, it was, what?
Yeah. You mean the big 20-page spread?
Yeah.
Back in, I think it was October of last year. Yeah, it's not good.
Dr. Alano, any remarks?
Yeah, I see that Dr. Dower recognized a problem and he dealt with it. He got rid of it. He got rid of it the right way.
It's tough to be a whistleblower, but you got to do it.
Yeah, that. I had spoke with not an attorney. Well, okay, he's an attorney, but he's not my attorney. Just kind of a general. And I guess I learned something about whistleblowing. I guess true whistleblowing. This could be a thing for Mr. How do you say your last name?
Monahan.
Yeah. About whistleblowing. I assume whistleblowing was when you saw something illegal or unethical and you brought to the attention of somebody. I should not have used the press. That was my dumbest decision. I probably should have. And I don't know what board to bring it to. Or that's some who I bring it to. I didn't want to get federal with it. I was having an issue with our contract locally with the Glendale office of Modern Vascular. So I just kept it local. And when I send an email to all of the Modern Vascular investors, 120 people on a listserv, that's what got my attention to the Arizona Republic reporter who then, you know, did an interview with me. And I was delighted because I thought, here's my chance to voice my concerns so other potential physician investors aren't going to get, you know, involved in something that I think was unethical. What I didn't know is I was dealing with a reporter who didn't like physicians, period. And you can sense that in his article.
Well, I will tell you, he contacted this board and wanted to speak with me, and no, did not happen.
I wish I was so wise. I'm wise and very
good. I'm going to make, yeah. So, I just think this is unfortunate.
Yeah.
That it happened. You know, we always learn from different things, so I just will just, you know, not move. My recommendation is we just leave things as are and not take any action.
Seconded.
Do you want me to make a direct motion for that or no?
You can just say take
no. Take no action then.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks for
thank you.
Right, exactly. Okay, so we're moving right along here because our we will be doing the other item on the investigation called 10. So let's go to our issuance of licenses. First one we have is Joseph Colasurdo. Does that sound pretty? I don't want to butcher anyone's name. This is an initial application for licensure. Doctor's licensed in New York. Also, everything's complete. Anybody have any questions or concerns on that application? Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept Dr. Colasurdo's application for initial licensure and initial dispensing registration. Everything's complete, fees are paid, and to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Our next one is Dr. Brian Hall. He is has been practicing in Ohio, so this is a license app via comedy. Everything's complete, fees are paid. Any questions or concerns on this application? Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept Dr. Hall's application for licensure via comedy. His fees, like I said, are paid, everything's complete, and to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, let's vote. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Next is Jacob Harder. This is an initial regular license application. This gentleman is in his residency and will complete on June 30th of 2023. Everything here is in place. Looks like he does have a Wisconsin license that expires June of 23. Any questions or concerns? I will make a motion then to accept the application for initial licensure and dispensing registration and to issue the license upon completion of the residency program.
Second.
And I should have included and issue that license upon payment of the fee, too.
You second it.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Our next is Karen Hunt, which is also application via comedy. She did have a previous license with us, and it was canceled due to non-renewal. Everything is in place here. Anybody have any questions or concerns? Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept the application for licensure via comedy for Dr. Hunt and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Daniel McAfee. This is also a regular license. Doctor has multiple licenses here. So any questions or concerns on this application? Okay, I'll make a motion to accept Dr. McAfee's initial application for licensure and dispensing and issue that license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And our last one here is Ramez Sakab. And you noticed in your supplement that we did receive the updated letter regarding his residency status, residency application, or his residency completion, which will be on the 27th of June of this year. So anybody have any questions there on his application? Okay.
Okay, so again, I'll make a motion to accept Dr. Sakab's initial licensure dispensing registration and to dispense that license upon completion of his residency program and payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All righty. I will move to, let's see here, number 7, which is about the Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards community discussion. Heather and I attended via Zoom on the 28th of February, the fall winter meeting of the FPMB. We were online here from 10 to 11:30. It was really a well attended by the member boards, and the community of practice session was where we discussed. We put out a, you know, a survey about topics that people would like to discuss, typically problems everybody's having at the state board level. Anyway, good participation, and the topics that we discussed were the following: license portability and licensure compacts. And one of the things that was brought up that Heather did quite a good discussion on with people, but, you know, we have these mandates for the universal recognition that comes from the state, from the governor, without the board's knowledge of that. So that was a pretty good discussion about that. We also had discussion on continuing education, but were valid sources. Do states require some online and in-person or all online, and how you track CMEs, and then enforcing of disciplinary actions with CMEs. Anything else I should add, Heather? It was really good. We're trying to, now we always take a survey after those, because people really want to, you know, there's a lot of times I think people want to say things, and we just, time goes so fast, so we're going to try to do more of them, and people have asked actually in the survey to have longer time, you know, add another hour on the thing, but that's kind of hard to do when everybody's got stuff to do over the state, you know, the executive directors are busy, and then whoever else is going to be attending, so it was a good meeting. So, do you want to do your report first? Seamus, how long do you need? Because it's set 9:17. Do you want to go first, or you want Heather to go first? What do you think? Okay, so we'll do Heather's executive director report under number 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. The first item on my memo is regarding our Assistant Attorney General. Friday is his last day. So we will be assigned a new Assistant Attorney General. I have not received any communication from the Attorney General's office yet, but we'll probably have an interim Assistant Attorney General until we have one assigned to us permanently. So I'll keep the board apprised on that matter. I do have an update on Ventia. After I had sent out board materials about a week later, we did go live with the last licensee portal. So licensees can now go online, submit address change requests, license verification requests, and so forth. Renewals obviously will not be opened up until 60 days prior to the license expiration date, so May 1st. There is one piece of the renewals that is still being configured, but I was assured that that would be completed prior to the renewal date. And then I provided a copy of the current budget. I can answer any questions on that. And then no new complaints have been received since I sent out the materials.
Isn't that nice?
And I can answer any questions.
I remember pages and pages. Yeah. So, you want to do the ledger update?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. You can see from my memo that the majority of the bills did not pass the House of Origin, so they died. The only bills that I can see, and I'll continue to monitor in case some deadlines were extended, but as far as I'm aware, they had to have been heard by now in the House of Origin. So the only bills that are still considered, you know, live, going through the process is SB 1078, which is the association bill. That did pass the Senate. It was transmitted to the House. Mr. Abadi from the association and I attended the House and Health Human Services Committee meeting on Monday, and it passed unanimously. And our vote was to transmit it back to the Senate to be transmitted to the governor's office. So I'll keep the board apprised on that. SB 1087 is the bill that requires boards to reduce or waive fees if the board's appropriation is going to, or if the board's fund is going to exceed 50% of the appropriation at the end of the fiscal year. So that still is awaiting a third read. I'm going to keep a close eye on that one, and I'll let the board know. And then SB 1333, it just requires boards to report any license revocations to Department of Health Services, and the Department of Health Services has to compile that information and create an online database, if you will. And that's it. Those are the only three bills that I see are still going through the process. And I can answer any questions on any of those bills.
Thank you, Lana. You have any questions for Heather?
No questions for Heather. Thank you, Heather.
And Shane has taught me if this is not the appropriate time, but I know that I've told the board in the past that, you know, I've held the rules regarding the podiatric medical assistance. So as soon as SB 1078 clears the process, then I intend to file those rules with the Secretary's office.
So they all go together.
We try to make them both become effective as close as close as possible, yeah. And I can answer any questions.
Summary of current events. Okay. We do not have public to call, so we'll move on from that. Anybody have any items they'd like? This is under 12. Any items for future meetings that they'd like discussed? Okay. And our next meeting will be April the 12th, 2023. So that leaves us would like to give your
functions right in.
Thank you.
I think I can
give
you that in 4 minutes. You know, maybe even with 5 minutes to spare, so you can have okay. We are going to cover the open meeting law. And I'm going to go back over just some basics. So,
all right, there we go. So, again, this presentation consists of two primary elements: directives based on state law and recommendations derived from years of practical experience representing state licensing boards. And then again, administrative law is not for sissies, so you should lean back, clutch the sides of your chairs, and steel yourself. That was a Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, actually.
Oh, it said that.
Parliamentary procedure, that kind of goes into open meeting law, so we'll hit that. Much of the work of the state boards is governed by state laws, for example, open meeting laws, conflict of interest, and public records laws. Where the state laws do not prescribe the board's conduct, some basic elements of parliamentary procedure can be useful in conducting board meetings. And again, parliamentary procedure for our purposes is usually Robert's Rules. Parliamentary procedures are guidelines for conducting meetings and making group decisions that cover such issues as making motions, discussing matters, and voting. Maybe informal or formal procedure, but must not violate the law. No one is to disturb another in the speech by hissing, coughing, spitting, speaking, or whispering to another, nor stand up or interrupt him. And why a lot of these Robert rules are important is in order to create an adequate record, an inaccurate record. When we talk over each other, or we don't allow one person to talk, then the record is not clear and it's not an even well-balanced record. It's one of the formal systems, the Robert rules, but not many. And again, your state statutes and rules will always trump those parliamentary procedure recommendations. So let's get down to, so again, during the meeting, the chair is going to maintain the order, does not do all the talking, does vote, encourages participation, helps equalize participation, prompts comments if necessary, clarifies or rephrases if necessary. Dr. Campbell, you do a very good job of that. Also assists you on staying on task, redirects members or speakers when necessary, presides over a formal hearing, assists in creating a clear and adequate record of the meeting. Again, as our last time that we had training, again, the most important thing is your record. All right, let's move past this. Open meeting law requires there to be a quorum. No quorum equals no meeting. The quorum for this board is three, as it is a four or a five-person board.
Five.
So, yeah, your quorum is three, and it's a five-person board. I forgot we've never had five members since I've been here. Best practices have a chair or staff member call the roll to identify the members who are present. Avoid conversations and whispering to each other. This could be seen as making deliberations without doing it on the record. Only one person speaks at a time. Don't interrupt another speaker. Do not talk over each other. Again, to help create that clear record. Another open meeting issue, dealing with disruptions. The public has a right to attend and to take photographs and audio record or video record, but may not disrupt the meeting. Do not permit members of the audience to shout out. Have a call of the public on the agenda to allow members of the audience to address the board in an orderly manner. And again, the call of the public is always optional, but it is a best practice. Anticipating possible disruption. Again, you can reach out. I don't believe it's Capitol Police. This is a little dated. I believe it's now DPS who handles any threats in the area. But Heather can handle that. And if there's any issues you foresee, you can always let her know. And she can request them to be at the meeting or to do a threat assessment. So for the purposes of the record, make sure that you call each item. Agenda item 3, motion for rehearing, filed by Jane Doe. That just helps those who are going back to review the record later. The chair may take things out of order in the agenda. No vote is necessary. It's in your agenda already, the language that the chair may do that, so public is on notice. Speak loudly and clearly. Don't mumble. Don't talk into your papers or your hand. The audience in the back of the room should be able to hear you. Use surnames, not first names, or respondent, that always helps, or doctor. Formal proceedings, public perception, it's very important. As you know, most people who come before the board are very, very nervous. This is a very important moment in their life, and so, showing them that respect and decorum is is paramount to being seen as a legitimate adjudicated body. Don't eat during the board meeting, it looks bad. Don't have conversations, don't take restroom breaks together and discuss things. Always be respectful, avoid offhand remarks, sarcasm, inappropriate humor, which I have not seen at this board. I think this board is very respectful. Treat people who appear before the board with dignity and respect. Express disapproval without scolding or belittling or browbeating. Once you've gotten an answer, move on. Pay attention and look like you are paying attention. licensees in the public place great weight on what members do and say at meetings. As you know, everything that we do here is immortalized into perpetuity. So if you don't want it, if you don't want people to know about it, don't say it. That's not an open meeting. Generally, a licensing board's primary duty is to protect the public. You do this in two ways. You license applicants who demonstrate that they meet the qualifications, and you also regulate licensees by receiving complaints, investigating those complaints, and adjudicating those matters. Always follow the board's statutes and rules. Even if in your opinion the rule is punitive or under punitive, just make sure that you are always following those rules and statutes, because when you don't, that's when you can be acting in bad faith. And when you act in bad faith, you open yourself up and the decisions of the board to potential liability. And if it's a matter in which we've discussed before, the Attorney General's office may not be able to represent you in that matter. This is a good one. I always like this. Public officials may not violate the plain terms of a statute because, in their opinion, better results will be attained by doing so. They have but one duty, and that is to enforce the law as it is written. And if the effect of their action is disastrous, the responsibility is upon the legislature and not upon them. But if they knowingly, even though with the best intentions in the world, violate the law, they and their bondsmen must take the consequences.
I think we forget that there's one dish that really is important to keep in mind all the time.
Yes.
Very.
I apologize. So I guess one thing I could say while I'm finding this, the one exception, so the open meeting law basically states that everything that the board does, every decision they make, every deliberation they make needs to be on the open record. Deliberations need to be on the open record. There's only going to be maybe four instances where your decisions or deliberations or discussions in general won't happen on the record, and that's executive session for the purposes of legal advice, executive session for the purpose of discussing matters that are expressly made confidential by law, discussing the performance of your executive director. And then there is also, the last one would be for the purposes of discussing ongoing litigation and where the board's going to go. So those are the four times that what you do is not going to be on the public record. However, any other time, what you will be doing is going to be on the public record.
So is that litigation that has to do with a licensee or another litigation?
It would that would only be at a time when the board has been threatened by litigation.
Right.
Or they're in litigation and trying to decide how to respond. That's a great question, though. I just lost it. How did you know when I said that? Can't believe that. Here we go. Found it.
So remind me, when, say, the board members are going to attend an association meeting. So in order to let them know that we're all going to be at the same place at the same time, but we're not holding a board meeting. Is that 24 hours, 3 days prior? Or when it, how you have to post that, that it's not a meeting?
It's usually the, generally always going to be 24 hours ahead of time, but yes, it is. The public has become sensitive to the board going to association meetings or things like that, in which they're all going to be present. And, you know, while a discussion is not going to take place, technically it could be considered a meeting, right? So in those instances, the executive director could always notice the public and just put a notice up that board members will be attending this. It is not a regular meeting. They will not be discussing board business together. And that just kind of is a CYA thing, right? Okay, so Arizona's open meeting law is driven by two core concepts that establish the base perspective from which public officers should evaluate them. First, the legislature mandated that all meetings of any public body shall be public meetings, and all persons so desiring shall be permitted to attend and listen to the deliberations and proceedings. Second, the legislature established the following public policy in the state. Meetings of public bodies be conducted openly, and that notices and agendas provided for such meetings, which contain such information as is reasonably necessary to inform the public of the matters to be discussed or decided. So, again, in Heather's always, she's got a great agenda, always, but, you know, matters to be discussed, where, what time, and always allowing the public to attend. Now, there was actually a recent bill the last 2 years to provide, they would mandate the boards to provide enough room for people to sit, right? And as you can see in this room, it could get very difficult for some kids. So the purpose of the open meeting law, it's got three main purposes. One is to protect the public, public officials, and the relationship between them. Promote accountability of public officials, and to encourage knowledgeable public participation. And who does the open meeting apply to? It applies to a public body. And public body is considered very vaguely. So it could be boards, commissions, and other multi-member governing bodies, quasi-governmental corporations, quasi-judicial bodies, advisory committees. So let's say you decide that you want a committee to look at your rules, and you create a rule committee. That rule committee would be subject to the open meeting law requirements as well, just as notice of proposed rulemaking meetings as well. What actions are covered? So all legal action of the public body, so kind of like we talked about before, all deliberations need to be on the record, and that way the individual sitting here and anybody who picks up that record afterwards understands why you did what you did and what the support was for that. Which also is very important for your attorney, because it allows me to go back and review the audio, which I often do, you know, if I'm preparing for a case or especially writing agreements. I will often go back just to make sure that I capture the language correctly. Any deliberations by the quorum, discussions, consultations among the majority of the members. So, and again, you're going to want to be careful to not talk about these things, right? One of the issues that comes up a lot is emailing. And one of the, you know, the worst case scenario, the very embarrassing scenario, is when board members start a chain discussion on email, and they're discussing board matters, and then they have to come before the board at the next meeting and read their emails into the record. Even if they're benign, that can be kind of an embarrassing moment. So just always be careful. Even sending an email to all members about a specific case can be considered a meeting. So
They don't respond.
Pardon me. And also in situations like what we had with when other board members get information, they should, you know, it's something that comes from the public, or like the article, the vascular.
Mm-hmm.
But that just goes directly to Heather, not to any other board members. Just send it to the executive director. Is that, you know, a better way to, and just that way it goes to, that there's no possibility for discussion.
Absolutely. Well, and that's always a difficult one because, you know, as being on the board and a professional, people are consistently reach out to you. You know, I constantly get those questions. People are constantly calling me and asking me about, you know, what I believe is board business or going to be board business. And I always say, you can't stop that. And no one's policing you. So just, you know, turn that information over and let the board handle it. And again, another thing that can happen is trying to splinter your quorum by, you know, I send an email to Heather, and let's say four of us are on a board, and I send a letter to Heather saying, or an email, who sends a letter? I send an email saying, hey, you know, I don't like this case, you know, I think we should dismiss it. How about you reach out to, you know, Dr. Foreman and Dr. Campbell and see if they agree, right? So you're kind of, you're doing what you can't do openly, clandestinely,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
It's not appropriate.
Absolutely. notices are very important. Also requires the taking of minutes. A lot of boards now use the audio. It's a lot easier to capture everything. You can capture the tone a lot better. Some boards do put up both, but it's not really a requirement. You really do need to be posted, one or the other, though. But best practice would be to post both, is what the auditor would tell you. So in addition to the notice of the time, date, and place of the meeting, the public body must provide an agenda of the matters to be discussed, considered, or decided. Agendas must contain information reasonably necessary to inform the public of the matters to be discussed or decided at the meeting. And you guys generally don't see that because that's handled by Heather and myself. But as I said before, Heather's really good at writing agendas, so there's really never any issues. But there can be small, minute issues that really create a big problem by the time you get to the meeting, such as, you know, hampering the board and not being able to discuss certain things. That doesn't seem to be an issue for this board.
So I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have called public, we don't know what's going to be brought up. Is there anything that says that if anybody wants to do a call to the public, that they have to contact the board in any way to say that?
Yeah, they can. You know, a lot of boards use the sign-in sheet just to make it easier,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have to. Okay. You can just show up and request to speak.
And you don't do have to do way to cover. Do they fill these out? I mean, if you have somebody who wants to do a call with the public, do they fill out the normal sheet?
Yeah. I believe so. Yeah.
We haven't had anything for so. I mean, just never happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other agencies I've worked at have.
Maybe. Okay.
I'm not sure that it's a requirement, but it definitely helps to track and make sure that everybody who wanted to speak was able to speak. Yeah. Yeah.
Do we have to give, is there a time limit on your speaking? I mean, I know we can't respond. I know that.
So you can respond actually in a very limited circumstance. You can respond with a call of the public in the circumstance where someone is criticizing the board or, you know, making a suggestion. It's okay for one board member to respond to that criticism, maybe to, you know, help to quell the issue, but you don't want to have a back and forth conversation. You don't want to have one board member. It rarely happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people don't show up to the call of public to criticize the board. These days, they can do that during the agenda items.
Mm-hmm.
But as for timing, it can be 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes. It's really up to you. The quorum. So, open meeting law defines gathering in persons or technological devices of a quorum of members of a public body at which they discuss, propose, or take legal action, including any deliberations of a quorum with respect to such action. So, there must be a quorum present, and when you lose quorum, the meeting immediately ends. Unless it's for, you know, just a recusal matter. Now, you may lose quorum to hear that matter, which then you would move to the next agenda. You would move to the next agenda. Sometimes, if you don't have enough people on the board, enough board members, and a complaint comes in against a board member, it can preclude you from hearing that because you don't have enough members, seated members, for a quorum to hear that.
But if somebody abstains, they're still counted on the quorum, right? Or no?
Well, a recused member can't abstain. A conflicted member can't abstain. They should always recuse.
Recuse, but if you abstain from voting, is there a difference between abstaining and recusing?
Yes. Yes. If you don't have a conflict, you can abstain, and then you don't lower the quorum number. However, if you recuse, then you lower the quorum number. Yes. And some board members will try to be tricky, and they'll abstain, right? So that the board doesn't lose quorum, but you don't know. You need to recuse on this matter. I get it, but you need to recuse. You can't just abstain. As we talked about, executive session. These are noticed on your agenda. We talked about the four that you're normally going to see. That's consideration of specifically enumerated employment matters, records exempt from public inspection by law, consultation for legal advice, and consultation with the attorneys in the public body in order to consider its position and instruct its attorneys regarding the public body's position in pending or contemplated litigation. So those are the main four ones. There are seven, but the other three you likely never ever use.
Mm-hmm.
We just talked to the call of the public. Call of the public is good. It allows the public to let you know how they're feeling, what they think about the board. It can head off a ombudsman complaint. If someone doesn't think you adjudicated something correctly, you can always, after the call of the public for the next meeting, agendize that to discuss. We discussed email communications. It does, email communications going to all members, unless it's a simple, will you be at the meeting? I'll be there. That's very different. But if you're discussing substantive matters, then it's technically a meeting. And it needs to be noticed 24 hours in advance. So again, the penalty for that is you come to the meeting and you read those emails into the record. If the open meeting law is violated, most likely the Attorney General's office will not represent you, because it may be the Attorney General's office or the county attorneys who are filing suit against you. So the civil violations, I believe, are up to $500 per violation of the open meeting law. And then again, there can also be removal from the board. There could be sanctions against your license for unethical behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And then public records. Public records is a big part of the open meeting law. A lot of the public records information and things like that are handled by Heather, and then secondarily myself or your attorney if she has questions. That the board is subject to the public records law, and public records law is pretty tough. So when you get a public records request, unless it's not something that you're required to keep, and then the second, that you don't keep, right? Because even if you're not required to keep something, but you do keep a list of it, and someone requests that, you have to turn it over. Jump in, please.
Shane is correcting me if I'm wrong. Board emails can be, and as Shane has said, you know, if you violate a public meeting law via email, then you have to read those into the record. But at any time, like my email could be requested as a public records request, and anything you do on your board issued laptops could be requested as a public records request, and we would be required to turn that over. Is that correct?
Yep. Yes, I get them at my office all the time.
And is that part of records retention too? Because when I was reading some of them, like, is that have to follow, you know, how long you keep those? Is that part of it?
Not part of the boards, but I believe that there's the state has one, you know, overarching retention for those, and I can get that information and give it to the board regarding emails and things like that. It's not something I know off the top of my head.
Yes, Heather is correct. Email communications of board members are a public record. And arguably, unless it's a one-on-one conversation with myself and a board member, there's not going to be any legal privilege to any of those emails. Those are going to be emails, you know, administrative emails, emails discussing things back and forth with Heather.
And so much of the time, those emails are in, you know, we have the emails that are in the board packets of stuff, you know, of the conversation. So mm-hmm. that's public record.
Well, in your board packets, it's technically not a public record because you... Because you have medical records contained in there.
Yeah.
So, and interestingly, Heather and I went through this right after I started with your board, where you got a public records request regarding a matter that was confidential because it contained the medical records. Yeah, and so while you don't have the statute, we had to use the overarching state law that says that these medical records are confidential. So
what kind of information can be released? What would, you know, is it like illicit licensees or something like that? Or
everything's a public record unless it contains confidential information, and even then, you know, the state has a duty to redact.
Right. Yeah.
It can be produced with, you know, without the information, and if the document is still, you know, a viable document, it's worth looking at without the personal information. So let's say that licensing, you get requests for licensing materials all the time. You turn over those licensing applications and materials, but what you do is you redact out any bank account numbers, any phone numbers, any addresses that aren't business addresses, things like that, any personally identifying information, or if there's PHI in there, right?
Right. So how do you redact that out? Is it just you extra it? Because, like, Heather's done some stuff.
Adobe.
You can add a redacting. Okay.
Yep. So, again, yep, emails are public record. Who's subject to public records law? the board members, the board's attorney, pretty much everybody. It's a big law, so. Preservation and maintenance generally. All records made or received by public officials or employees in the course of their public duties are the property of the state. Each public body and officer is responsible for preserving, maintaining, and caring for the public records within their offices. Each officer and public body is required by statute to carefully secure, protect, and preserve public records from deterioration, mutilation, loss, or destruction unless the records are disposed of pursuant to ARS Section 411347, which is going to be your records retention schedule. Did you want to say something?
Yes, Madam Chair, board members, I have been thinking about the retention schedule for emails, and I believe that it is once the need is met for emails. So, like, whenever I complete an email, respond back, you know, to whether it's a licensee, an applicant, I delete it. I delete my emails. And I believe unless that's changed, I believe it's once the need is met. So you could just get into the habit of deleting emails after you know, the need is met. But I will make sure that is correct. I'm sure that I'm right. Otherwise, I wouldn't delete my emails. But I can get that information for the board. Sure.
Because I know I ask myself that all the time. Because I, you know, I put things into files. And I'm like, well, should I keep this or what?
Me personally, I try to get rid of everything I can as soon as I can.
Yes, I'm archiving right now, and it's taking a long time. Okay, and then inspection of public records. So the right to inspect documents is not unqualified. So it's not an absolute right. However, you know, a lot of the arguments that you would usually use, such as, you know, unduly burdensome, they're not going to work when it comes to a public records request. Unless they're asking, you know, if they're asking for, like, you know, every complaint ever filed against anybody, you know, maybe that can be cold, maybe, but that's a big ask, right? And then are you going to have to go through every complaint and redact, right? So there may be things where you could argue that that's just way too onerous, but the expectation in the statute and by the legislature is that when somebody requests that you promptly produce that material.
That's a bad term.
Yes. Yes, it's not, there is no defined time frame, but it is as quickly as you can, basically.
As reasonable and customary in the community is what I believe.
Luckily, most people are reasonable.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes a lot of work on Heather's behalf to, you know, reach out to him and say, hey, are you okay with, you know, this? Can you give me a little more time? What's your time frame? Do you want a rolling production, right? So that's always a big part of it as well. Denying public inspection. So the other place that you can, the other thing that you can do is you can request to come in at a reasonable time and review the records that you are requesting. So you can come in and review them in the board's offices as opposed to having to request them all. And again,
copies allowed then?
You can take copies.
That's any
probably get charged for it. Yeah, I mean, I've even seen attorneys take pictures of certain documents on their cell phones,
mm-hmm.
Which is fine. It's up to them. So again, the records that you're not going to turn over are the records made confidential by statute, which for you guys is going to be the fact that you have medical records. If you don't have medical records or financial information, in the majority of your cases, you're not going to have a strong confidentiality statute because there's a presumption that there's not a lot of protected information in there. So the record involves the privacy interests of persons, and that really is just, you know, using that public record request in order to get, you know, information that may shed light on somebody poorly to use in a divorce case, things like that, right? So privacy interests are very important, especially with children. I'm sure the DCS denies a lot of requests for public records requests for information regarding children because of their privacy interests. Disclosure would be detrimental to the best interests of the state, and I'm not even going to touch that one because that's a very vague and broad term. And whenever I brought that up, I've been told don't use that. And then of course the duty to redact. So all PHI, all PII, any identifying information should be taken out. And then consequences of wrongful refusal to disclose, attorney's fees. I haven't seen anything where you can be actually prosecuted for wrongful refusal to disclose, but it could carry some substantial damages for the board itself. And then just lastly, just a few tips to leave you with that we've already talked about, but remember every issue on the agenda has an impact on someone, whether it's a certificate holder, or a licensee, or someone who wants to become a license holder or a member of the public. Come to the meeting prepared, speak loudly and clearly. Do not mumble. Do not talk into your papers or your hand. The audience in the back of the room should be able to hear you. Avoid inappropriate humor, offhand remarks, sarcasm. Always be civil. Treat people who appear before the board with dignity and respect. Pay attention and look like you are paying attention. Turn off cell phones, or for emergencies, put them on vibrate. Do not talk on a cell phone during the meeting. Step outside. Do not read or send emails or text messages during the meeting. Licensees / certificate holders and the public place great weight on what board members do and say at meetings. If you wouldn't want a remark to be posted on the internet, printed in a paper, or read aloud in court, then don't say it. Remember, the meetings are digitally recorded, and the recording is a public record. Therefore, even if there is no public at the meeting, it doesn't mean that no one can find out what was said. Be familiar with the board's statutes and rules, particularly those that pertain to discipline and qualifications for licensure. Licensees / certificate holders are entitled to have the board make decisions based solely on the facts presented in the case in front of them. Individual board members should not go out and do their own investigation or research. Doing so may disqualify the board member from participating and jeopardize the board's decision. However, professional board members may and should apply their own experience in training in disposing of matters. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, it's 10 a.m. I'm going to call for a 5-minute recess before we finish our last item of business.
Sure.
Thank you. Appreciate it. My coffee is warm. You know everything, right, Alvin? Yeah, we always can learn, that's for sure. Since we're not attorneys.
A little some attorneys know.
Yes, ma'am. I have had that experience.
Yes. How many times I've had had my business lawyer represent me at the it didn't go well, did it? Everybody's ready? We'll go back on the record then.
All right, back on record at 10:06 a.m. All right, we have a fine today, which under 5A, investigation files 22-05-C, which is Dr. Seth Clark and his counsel, Mandy Carvis, is present. Good morning to everyone.
All right, this
is a continuation from, we had originally heard this case was in August, right?
Madam Chair, board members, it was the November 9th, 2022 meeting, and the board had voted to direct Seamus and Dr. Clark's attorney, Mandy Carvis, to enter into negotiations for a consent agreement with probation attached and a chart audit.
Right. And we have received information that Dr. Clark is refusing any probation as would affect his participation as a preferred provider with insurance companies. Correct? Okay. So there's, I don't believe, any need to reiterate from the board materials as far as complaint and the medical history. We're back with the issue of charting and documentation. So, what are our possibilities here is what we need to discuss as far as how to handle this situation. Ms. Carvis has presented to us information regarding the PACE program, which was something that was presented as a possibility.
And you can get a statement from them if you want, if they'd like to make a statement.
Okay, I'll do that before we move on to the discussion. Okay, so.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Foreman, members of the board present here. as indicated, this in the November meeting, this was not a care. This was not a care-related issue. You guys found that the care provided was appropriate. It was more of a documentation issue, for which Dr. Clark has appeared before this board before. The timing of this care was within one record-keeping system. It's different now. He believes that his documentation is certainly improved and is compliant with what this board wants. The concern with the potential consent agreement for probation relates to the hassles and headaches that that causes in terms of being a preferred provider for insurance companies. So in an attempt to try to balance both of those things, to reassure this board that Dr. Clark understands documentation and the expectations thereof, but also to attempt to avoid probation, we presented information about the PACE program, and that's Physician Assessment and Clinical Education Program, which is through UC San Diego School of Medicine. They offer courses on various topics, including record keeping. This course is utilized by the Arizona Medical Board and the Osteopathic Board when they have concerns with respect to documentation. I provided a brief summary of the course, but it's rather extensive. It's 17 continuing medical education hours specifically on documentation. It does include avoidance of deficiencies in the medical record, CMS guideline and coding, medical informatics and the medical record, the electronic medical record, which obviously everyone is using at this point. And it also includes a chart review workshop, individual personalized review and critique of medical and billing records. So it is quite an extensive program, probably more continuing education hours than would typically be mandated for continuing education. But again, to try to balance the needs here, we would be willing to have Dr. Clark undertake that course at his own expense, obviously. It's a $1,300 course. There is still time for him to enroll in the April 27th of 2023 course. Right now, the status as of this morning, it was still open. He has until April 6th to register for that. If this board were to allow him to take this course to address the concerns in this case, he would go ahead and sign up for that course to be completed. Assuming there's still space by the time he gets back to the office, he would complete that at the earliest opportunity and provide the board proof of completion of that program. And we would ask that the board consider that as a resolution of this matter as opposed to probation, continuing education or records monitoring, which would be problematic for them.
I had a question, Ms. Carvis, about the program. I like that. I went on and looked at the website, and it said that there's obviously it's a third party, and they would be the ones reviewing the progress. How often they do that? I mean, as far as following, if they're going to have like a test patient or something where the doctor has to chart, or there's going to be somebody that's going to look over this across the past sections? Or?
Sure. From my understanding, and Dr. Campbell, I just want to make sure I'm addressing your specific question. Are you talking about the chart review?
Yes, ma'am.
So my understanding from physicians who've taken the course in the past is that they provide a select chart or charts for someone who is an instructor in the course to review, and they speak with them about whether or not that meets the generalized requirements. Now, obviously, every state has some nuances there, but it's more big picture best practices in terms of, SOAP format, are we explaining rationale for decisions, things of that nature. So obviously, it would be up to Dr. Clark or any individual practitioner to know the state-specific requirements, but they do actually review clinical charts. I don't know if there's a set minimum or anything like that. It's been a little while since I've had someone specifically go through that, and I obviously am not directly involved in that process, but from my understanding, it's more than one, and it is an individualized review where they provide the provider with suggestions for ways to improve documentation if they identify any such issues.
And I also noticed on the PDF for signing up for that you have to release information to the boards you have and to attorneys and to any hospital that you have privileges. Is that how the-
That's my understanding.
Okay,
yes, and depending on the purpose of the course, obviously, it will ask you things on the application in terms of why you're taking it. Are you just doing this for your
personal
certification, for your continuing education credit, or is this ordered by someone? Because they do, I think, for their own metrics also, they probably like to track the reasons for people taking the course. But it is, again, widely utilized by the Arizona Medical Board.
And I think it's a, I think it's a good option for that too, just because there's a third set of eyes looking at something. And that's important. We just had another perspective on it, so.
May I make a quick comment?
Sure. Actually,
I called the program as well because I wanted to know about what the chart review was. And I just said, hey, you know, if we're going to be requesting some charts to review, I said, I'm a surgeon, you know, am I allowed to kind of pick? And so they told me that basically they'll allow me to submit documentation for whatever I want to. So my plan would be to submit one of my recent surgeries, and then what they do is their experts then comb through every single note, and they say, hey, this one might not have included something, or this, or whatever, which is, I really think, is what the board is kind of wanting. You know, with the chart review, if you guys were to do it, I think that's what you would want to see is, for a surgical patient, you know, is the post-operative progress being charted a little bit better, that sort of thing. So I would have that liberty to kind of give a recent surgical patient and all of the documentation so they can just comb through all of it and give suggestions. So I believe that that specific part would be extremely beneficial for me.
Now, is there a time frame that they have? The course is 2 days. So I would estimate that this procedure is going to take more than 2 days of clinical, or the class, that for them to evaluate and everything.
For them to look actually.
Yeah, to look at the, right.
Yeah, and what I don't know, Dr. Campbell, is, and I don't know if Dr. Clark spoke with them about this, but is it that he selects the chart and submits it to them in advance of taking the course? That way, when you get to that portion of the course where it's the chart review workshop, that they've already had the opportunity to complete that review. That's my understanding as to how that
Yes, and that was the understanding they gave me. They said that they have the enrollment cut off for that exact reason. That way, almost a month in advance, so that gives their reviewers at least 2 or 3 weeks to look through the charts that you did give them so they can give the feedback. So yes, my understanding is that's how that works.
I would think that could cause a real big backlog.
And I think that's why cutoff is so far in advance, and they only offer it a certain amount of times per year. That way they are making sure that they have adequate time in order to complete the review of those who have registered for the course. And from my understanding, they will only allow so many people to register at a given time, which is why they can change the status of registration from open to close if they get too many people before the cutoff.
So, that's probably as a direct question, but I would hope that they have a limited number of participants so that they can make sure they do an excellent job.
That's my understanding. I don't know what the cap is, but there is a cap as to how many people can participate at a given time, and that's why they do the cutoff several weeks in advance of the actual.
And also, after the course ends and they, you know, and the reviews have been done, do they have any like follow up to check back in and how things are?
That I don't know, to be perfectly honest with you, Dr. Campbell.
Okay.
Well, and I would, you know, if this is something that we agree upon, I would think it's probably the would have communication about where things are with the court. I mean, where the progress is as far as, you know, this part's been done, we're waiting for this, or...
Absolutely. We would submit any documentation that Dr. Clark receives in terms of his completion and participation in the program. I don't know if he would receive specific feedback from them regarding the chart review workshop, but if he does receive specific feedback, we would certainly be happy to see that.
Just one, sir.
Dr. Foreman, can you speak up to the mic, please?
Sorry, I shut the mic off. Thinking about the future in 6 months from now with a voluntary chart review of maybe a couple of patients, is that something we can do, Seamus? Or?
Require probation.
Okay.
Pardon me, it's frog in my throat. Dr. Ilana, do you have any comments or questions or thoughts?
No, I'm in support of going through the program. I just want to make, the history of this is, the doctor will be starting, and I think this would be beneficial for the doctor, for all actually, the administration. So I'm supporting this.
Thanks. Well, and Dr. Foreman, in regards to your comment about 6 months from now, and, you know, as Seamus indicated, that is a probationary thing. We can, in addition to accepting the use of the PACE program to do a degree of censure that was in regards to the continued documentation and communication problems that we've had, even with all the previous attempts at rehabilitation that we've done in the past. We can do that in addition. So that's a thought, if you have.
Sure, I support that performance. And I'd like to review and see how well the project has gone.
Dr. Yolanda, could you repeat that? You kind of muffled there, and I didn't get everything that you said.
Oh, sure. I support to review a chart maybe 6 months after you go through the program, what that performance says. I'd like to see this progress after taking this program.
Well, and again, as Seamus indicated, that's considered a probation, and again, that's one of the items that, you know, that Dr. Clark has indicated that he's doesn't want to have a probation because of the effect of preferred provider status and insurance companies. So that's why I made the discussion or the recommendation of doing a decree of censure regarding that charting. And of course, if something came up down the line, then we have other options to address or proceed with.
And the decree of censure, Dr. Ilana, it's disciplinary, but it doesn't impose any restrictions or requirements on the license.
Thank you, Sharon.
So, any discussion with you on this?
How a six-month review by, put that in the agreement by a professional, not the board, would that work? Also, so it's not a set, it wouldn't be, it would still be included.
It's still,
I'm trying to figure it back.
No, it's pretty clear, yeah. So, I'm giving you another opportunity, Dr. Milano. I don't want to leave you out because we're not seeing your smiling face. So, anything else you'd like to say, or comments, or questions?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Dr. Foreman.
I'm okay with trusting that this works, and then obviously if in the future something happens, the documentation will show improvement.
Well, I can make the, you know, I can make a motion that may not, you know, may not pass, but I'm going to go ahead then and make a motion. We'll have two parts. It should be done separate. To offer a decree of censure and then accept the PACE program as a non-disciplinary action. Offer, make it.
I think you could do it in one motion.
Okay. Well, then that's what I'll do. Okay, so
offer a consent agreement for a decree of censure and a non-disciplinary order for CE in the PACE course.
So my motion is this. I'm going to offer a consent agreement in the form of a decree of censure regarding the continued issues with documentation that have had previous attempts at rehabilitation that have not held. In addition to that, we'll accept or we'll agree to a non-disciplinary CME with the PACE program for the documentation medical records. 35 days to appeal on the censure?
Yeah, he has 35 days.
35 days to appeal on the censure, okay. Do I have a second? Thank you, Dr. Alano. Time for more discussion if anybody has one. Any? I'm sorry?
No.
Okay. And then we will take a roll call vote, correct?
Okay. Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Alano?
Aye.
Motion carries.
So we'll be dealing with you.
Friday.
Yeah, I didn't know if you had had your discussion yet, so that's why I was just kind of, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so, that's it, I think. Anybody has anything else they need to say or do? Thanks. Oh, certainly, certainly. All right. I believe we have completed all agenda items. Is there anything, any other comments or concerns to be addressed? All right, hearing none, I will make a motion to adjourn the meeting at 10:26 a.m.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved.